As the text begins with the third person singular, he, this is still Lysias, the Roman tribunal, a tribune would be a commander of maybe 1,000 people. In modern days, something like a little battalion, I would say, infantry battalion. Verse 23 of Acts 23, then Lysias, the tribune, called two of the centurions and said, get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. And he wrote a letter to this effect. And by the way, you have to keep in mind that there's a plot to kill Paul, and this is now what Lysias, the tribune, does in response to having become privy to this plan to kill Paul on the road. Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about question of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with them. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's Praetorium. And after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus. They laid before the governor their case against Paul, and when he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation, in every way and everywhere we accept this with all gratitude. But to detain you no further, we beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. For we have found this man a plague, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him about everything of which we accuse him. The Jews also joined in the charge, affirming that all these things were so. And when the governor had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied, knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. You can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem. And they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues or in the city. Neither can they prove to you what they now bring up against me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. Now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple without any crowd or tumult. But some Jews from Asia, they ought to be here before you and to make an accusation, should they have anything against me. Or else let these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council, or other than this one thing that I cried out while standing among them, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today. But Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying, when Lysias the tribune comes down, I will decide your case. Then he gave orders to the centurion that he should be kept in custody but have some liberty, and that none of his friends should be prevented from attending to his needs. After some days, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, and he sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And as he reasoned about righteousness and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix was alarmed and said, "Go away for the present. When I get an opportunity, I will summon you." At the same time, he hoped that money would be given him by Paul. So he sent for him often and conversed with him. When 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. Now, this is the second legal proceeding against the Apostle Paul, and it takes place in the Roman city of Caesarea, a port city in fact, it is in today's Israel, in the northern part of the coast. Caesarea was the capital of the imperial province of Judea. Imperial provinces were more like military zones. They were a little more unstable than senatorial offices, which were peaceful and fairly prosperous. These were recent acquisitions, and Judea was one of the smallest of the imperial provinces, and certainly also one of the most troublesome. As you know, this is a time in just about the mid-first century when the nation of Israel is slowly slipping into a mode of instigating what is known in the history books as the Jewish Wars from 66 through 70. And violence and vandalism picked up momentum in these days. And this, of course, was known to the Romans. A governor like Felix, who is mentioned so many times in this text, therefore would not only have financial responsibilities, that is to say, to gather the taxes that the emperor required from these imperial provinces, but he also commanded auxiliary forces, military forces, to keep the peace, even though a small province like Judea would not have legions stationed in Caesarea, but maybe a couple of thousand, maybe even a few more. The imperial province of Judea itself was overshadowed by a much larger territorial entity, the imperial province of Syria to the north and the northeast. And the legate of the imperial province of Syria was higher ranking than the procurator or the governor of Judea, even though both of them acted independently. But in case of war, and this again would soon be a reality in Palestine, the higher ranking official could intervene in a place like Jerusalem or in Judea in more general terms. Now, this is the only time that you hear of Felix in the book, and I will say a few things more about this character to fill in some of the holes, because you don't really see much of who this person is or what he was known for, except that he is struggling with conflicting desires. On the one hand, he is he's afraid. He's scared when he hears Paul's reasoning of righteousness, self-control, and the coming judgment. But at the same time, he also is greedy, hoping that he would receive a bribe from him to release him. Now, this is the only time in the book of Acts that Paul actually is given a real trial, and the structures of Roman law court procedures are observable. And these, by the way, have informed the Western, at least the continental systems of law or judicial proceedings accordingly. The prosecution presents the charges. You have this Tertullus, whom the high priest and the Sanhedrin had hired. Tertullus, you need to think of this man as not only an orator and a flatterer, which he is obviously very good at, but he is a lawyer. And so he presents their case as the prosecution before the governor. Then, after that, the case is to Paul to defend himself, and eventually the whole thing is remanded to the governor, to the judge, to either render an immediate decision right there on the spot, to render a verdict, or postpone the verdict indefinitely, which was not uncommon. And as you can see, this was the choice of Felix. I will hear you at a later point. Now, the lawyer that the Jews had hired, this orator Tertullus, accuses Paul of three illegalities. Can you identify them in the text? What are the three things that Paul is being charged with? It's in the first 10 verses. So the first is that he has found a plague, the Greek word for pest. That's an accusation. He's found to be a pest, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews. So the first accusation is, I only would have to say, it's a politically motivated accusation. He incites people to rebellion against imperial interests. What's the second accusation? Well, you just have to go down to verse 5b. He's said to be a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. The appeal here is more religious. What is being said is that he leads a religious movement or a religious group that is not sanctioned by the empire and is not part of Judaism. If this was the case, and that of course needed to be proved, but if this was the case, then you would still have to show that there was a threat to imperial interests, and that demanded a verdict. All of this is very, very uncertain. The third charge is that he profaned the temple in Jerusalem. Now, which one of these three charges do you think is the most significant one? The first one, yeah. Without a doubt, for a Roman procurator like Felix, the first is the most significant one because it is politically charged. And if it could be proved that Paul was inciting people to rebel against the law and against the empire, then he would have been in trouble indeed. And so Paul takes up these accusations in order. Let me quickly run through them and show you how Paul responds in verses 11 through 13. He responds to the most important accusation. And what is he saying? He says, there's an absence of proof of any of the stuff that I'm accused of. I never argued in public to incite a crowd. I never stirred up people to rebel. None of this is true. And he does draw attention to the fact that it has only been 12 days ago that all this started. 12 days ago he was in the temple, and then everything started to unwind. And since this was less than a fortnight old, Paul says, you can still investigate the matter. It's open to investigation. It could still be reconstructed, and you could still find out the truth of this matter. And so he deals with the first charge. There's no proof, and it is only a short time ago. It can still be investigated so as to rectify the matter. And then the second charge of being a ringleader of an unsanctioned sect, how does Paul answer that charge? Verses 14 and 15. He claims that the way, as he calls Christianity or the Christian religion, the way was essentially continuous with Jewish belief, with Judaism. Essentially continuous. What do you think about that? Do you think that that's... Luke Timothy Johnson calls this a bogus defense. Paul knew it's not true. Paul knew that Christianity is not a subset of Judaism, and it is not continuous with Judaism. Is this a bogus defense that is only being produced because Paul knows where he is and what is happening to him, what is required by the situation? What do you think?
Would he be appealing to the prophecies?
such as? I think so. Does he mention the prophets in his defense? Yes, he does. He mentions the law and the prophets, right? Can you think of a New Testament passage in the epistles of Paul where Paul would argue a case in terms of Christianity or the faith of the way, using the language of Acts chapter 24, is continuous with the faith of the fathers, even the forefathers of the Jews? Can you think of a passage in the New Testament? You can't? Yes. Yeah. No, but it does. I mean, you're beginning to think in biblical terms, and when you start doing this, usually you see more, and there will be more evidence that you can gather from different places. Genesis 15:6, of course. Abram believed God and was credited to him for righteousness. That is a key text as Paul saw it, and listen to what he does with it in Galatians chapter 3. Arguing, essentially, that the faith is a natural, necessary outgrowth of the Jewish faith, Old Testament belief. Galatians 3:7, know then that it is those of faith who are the sons of Abraham. Sons of Abraham. That goes all the way back to Genesis 12:1-3. All the way. And the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abram. He goes on to say in 3:14, in Christ Jesus, the blessing of Abraham, again 12:1-3 in Genesis, might come to the Gentiles so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith. He makes a large canopy of words covering the entire Old Testament history and says, where we are in the history of redemption is not by accident. This is a logical conclusion to the plan of redemption. It is all coherent, all of one piece, one fabric, all connected to the very beginning of the Jewish faith, Genesis 12:1-3. And in this he makes an argument for the continuousness of the Christian faith with the Jewish belief, the Old Testament faith of God's people. So if you are a man like Paul, standing trial for the preaching of the gospel, you couldn't call this a bogus defense. If he really believes what he preaches, then he has every right to say, this faith that I preach, the gospel that I preach, is continuous with the faith of my fathers, even of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's continuous. It's a fulfillment of all this. So it's not a bogus defense. Well, and then the third accusation, he defiled the temple. He turns this on its head and he deals with it in very, very brief and cursory fashion. He says, well, where are the people that saw me in the temple? You should produce these witnesses. If you make these accusations, bring them here. It is the prosecution's burden to produce these witnesses. They are not here. You cannot simply walk around and say, I saw Paul on a broomstick flying around the praetorium at midnight on the 13th of such and such a month. You need to provide proof for this. And Paul says, I was in the temple, that is true, but not as someone who makes an impure or an unholy approach. I was a purified man in the temple according to the law. If there are those who say that I defiled the temple, they must be here, but they aren't. And in this, by the way, he also slaps the defense. He shows that they did not have the time or did not take the time to put together a watertight brief for the occasion. It was just a very, very haphazard attempt to pull a verdict over Paul. and didn't work. Now at this point, the text shifts the attention to Felix, the governor, the procurator of Judea. This verses 22 through 27, and notice how Luke refers to Felix as a man who was fairly well informed about the Christian movement. Young as it was, the text says in verse 22, having had a rather accurate knowledge of the way. Felix, by this time, had been procurator of Judea for about 6 years, give or take one, perhaps. And by inserting this statement, Luke, or the narrator, is implying that Felix, at least in a general sense, must have agreed with Paul's rendition. Namely, that even though Christianity or the way could be conceived as a marginal movement on the fringes of Judaism, it was not a political threat to the empire. The people who followed the way were not people who were inciting others to insurrection against the empire. It was not a political case against Paul. It could not be made. It could not stand. And so the charge of religious heresy simply did not impress a man like Felix very much. But all this does not move Felix to do what he should have done. What should he have done? He should have released Paul right there on the spot. There was no ground for any of those charges, but he kept him in prison. Felix's promise to Paul to decide the matter at a later point, he says, I will decide this matter when Lysias, the tribune, comes up here, and I want to hear from him what's going on, was unnecessary, and Felix knew this as well. By the way, Lysias, whether there was an agreement for him coming to Caesarea or not, Lysias really could not add anything at all to the account. And it could not be expected. This was simply a delaying tactic so that he would indefinitely draw out the proceedings and not put off the Jews. He knew what was right. He knew what he should have done, but he didn't do it because of political interests. And then, as you look at the text here in verses 24 through 27, there's a second informal hearing in which Felix listens to Paul. And then there are several subsequent hearings. Again, you can think of Paul being brought out of his cell and into the presence of the procurator, and then they have a little talk, and Paul gets to speak about what motivates him and what he believes and what he stands for, all with the same result. Felix refuses to let Paul go. So now let me give you a little background on this Felix. Felix and his younger brother had been the favorite slaves at the emperor's court, Claudius Caesar, and they racked up so much support at the court of the emperor that they became very powerful individuals. And eventually, the emperor decided to give the elder of the two, Felix, a run at the open position in Judea, the procuratorship. The procuratorship in Judea, since the time of Pontius Pilate, had become a bit of a hot seat. And Pontius Pilate is certainly a name that rings a bell with you. Since him and since his dismissal, the governors of Judea came and went, easy come, easy go. They came and left after very short intervals and had to be replaced. So the governor, the emperor said, let's give this smart slave with this Machiavellian instinct a chance. Give him a run at it. See what he can do in Judea. And even though the history of the governors in Judah was as I just told you, very brief tenures, very difficult, great difficulties for these people to bring the people together and to preserve the peace and not to raise the attention or the eyes of the emperor on this spot, even though the situation was as I just tried to summarize, this challenge did not really scare a man like Felix. Tacitus, who is a Roman historian, characterizes Felix as a man with an instinct of a beast. He speaks of him in the following words: Felix thought that he could commit all evil with impunity, wielding his kingly authority with the spirit of a slave, in all cruelty and in all lust. So the court of Felix was known to reek with greed, with blood, and with debauchery. And his Jewish wife Drusilla stood not behind him in any way. She was a good match for Felix. In fact, she was certainly as frivolous as Felix himself. Drusilla, by the way, was the daughter of Herod Agrippa I, whom we had been introduced to in Acts chapter 12, the man who imprisoned Peter and killed James, and then was killed himself, being struck by the angel. Acts chapter 12, he died in the year 44, in the fourth year of Claudius Caesar. And Drusilla so was married to the client king of Syria, not the governor of or the procurator of Syria, but the client king of Syria. And she broke that marriage and left her husband for Felix. So this was a nice couple. A nice couple, and when they listened to Paul, verse 24, in an informal hearing, they got more than they had bargained for. Paul was a prisoner, yes, but he preached to them of righteousness, self-control, and the coming judgment, says the text in verse 25, and the topic seems to have been tailored for the occasion and for the people who heard what Paul had to say. Although Felix is shown to be a man who is not too callous to be moved, the text says that he was scared, he was alarmed when he heard these things. He is also a man with competing desires. He does have the desire to be right with God. He wouldn't be alarmed if he wouldn't. So he wants to be right, but he is also a greedy man. At the same time, verse 26, he hoped that money be given to him by Paul. So, did Felix make a decision in this informal hearing? He used the tactics of delay in the official hearing, but in the subsequent hearings, when he talked to Paul and Paul got to preach to him, did he make a decision there? Yes, he did. He decided against the truth. He decided against the gospel, because delay, the delay of a decision, is a no to the truth. It's no. Can you tell me the reason why he reacted this way? Why did he not turn? He was so close. He heard the gospel, he was alarmed, and yet he was not moving in the right direction. He stood his ground, and that was as good as saying, no. No. Why did he do that? Does the text say the reason? Does it say why?
Procrastination.
Okay. The first reason that I would see in this text, as Gary says, is get rid of the unpleasant thing. Now the text says that he was alarmed when he heard of Paul's reasoning of righteousness, self-control, and the coming judgment, and he wants to get rid of the unpleasant subject. And I think that this is something that we're all familiar with, that we felt in one point or another. You can say, I believe, I know that I'm bad, I know that I've done wrong, I know that I deserve judgment, but I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to hear it. Get rid of the unpleasant subject. It's a way of warding off the truth. And it's like physical pain. You want to get rid of it. If you suspected to be insolvent, financially insolvent, and yet refuse to take a look at the bank statements that keep pouring into your mailbox and refuse to open the bills, as some of you ladies, I understand, are in the habit of doing, that is, you don't open bills, you leave it to your husband to do that. If you were to do all this, would you not be a fool? You would not be called a wise man. If you suspect that you're insolvent, and you don't open your bills, and you don't want to get an accurate picture of where you are, financially speaking, you're a fool. And this is precisely what you can see here. Getting rid of the unpleasant subject doesn't make the trouble go away. Little children, when they're scared, sometimes go like this. Because it is believed that if you don't see it, it's not there. It's not true. Adults are not that much different from children, are they? Now, the fear of judgment, of course, is not an end to itself. And the fear of judgment does not last. I could preach to you all day long about the fear of judgment, and if God so wished to deal with you, you could walk home shaking in your boots, but it will wear off. It cannot last forever. So the effect will wear off. And if it doesn't lead to Christ, then it doesn't lead to reformation, and it doesn't lead to life. Instead, it will result in a hardening of heart. And I think that you can see this in Felix as well. Even Christians, if we resist the truth, we are less likely to be touched by it the next time. We are less likely to be touched by the message of the gospel for every time that we resist it. The second reason, or maybe you can think of it, can you see another reason why Felix acts the way that he does? It's not only that he wants to get rid of the unpleasant thoughts and the darkness that suddenly falls upon him when he thinks about the coming judgment and his sinfulness. Yes?
He was afraid of the Jews.
Yeah, that's true. Political reasons, yeah. He is a man pleaser after all, and when, you know, the conflict is doing what is right and pleasing people, it's a no-brainer. Please the people, keep the peace. I think we've taken a page out of that book too from time to time, more concerned about what people think or how they react to us than really what God thinks and what is right after all. That's not an open ticket to just do what you want to and say what you want to when you want to. But it is something that I can see in myself, and I'm sure you can too. I see other reasons for this man acting the way that he does. Can you? How about the factor of time? I've said several times that he is employing delaying tactics. So he is saying there is time yet. That even if I do not respond today, then I will have an opportunity in the future. He says what so many people are saying in this world. In fact, I remember the story of an older Christian who had a friend, an unbeliever. They maintained a good relationship over the years. He was a barber, and he would go there, and every time he would go there, knowing that he was a Christian, he would talk about religious things, and he would listen. And every time he would, you know, hear about the gospel or at least something that relates to the gospel, he would go like, "Yeah, yeah," but he would never turn. Only "yeah." But he would never change. Eventually, a sudden sickness, brief struggle, dead. And the man was carried to his grave most likely from all that we know, an unsaved man, because he postponed a decision. He never really faced God, and now he will have to do it in eternity. There is time yet. Many people say this. His way, that is Felix's way of saying this, verse 25, go your way for this time. Go your way for this time. I will hear you again. This is easy. Easy to say, but the consequences can be dire. You do not know what shall be tomorrow. And that's why the writer to the Hebrews says in 3:7, quoting Psalm 95, today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your heart. For every time you harden your heart, you're less likely to hear the gospel. Christians can come to the point where only a sovereign intervention from God can rescue them from their own sin. We've seen this morning in Samson, haven't we? Samson was a man of faith. Hebrews 11 does not leave any doubt about that. But what a life. What a character. And he got to the point where he was so playing around with his sin that he had chosen for himself, that he preferred, that only a sovereign act of God could pull him out of that quagmire. And it did cost him his life as well. Is there another reason that you can see for Felix acting the way that he does? Right. And this is what David said earlier. He has political interests. He's trying to please the Jews. That's true.
Greed.
There it is. And that's obvious. It's in the text. He says it in verse 26. At the same time, that is, while he was alarmed, there was a competing desire for money. The desire to be right with God was there when he heard the truth, and the desire to be enriched. Greed. He hoped that money be given to him by Paul. Greed wins out in Felix's case. And it is greed and not ignorance that keeps Felix from the faith. Jesus used to say, if your eye offends you, gouge it out and cast it away from you. It is better that you enter into eternal life having only one eye than to have both eyes and to be cast into eternal hellfire. Felix cannot give up his earthly passions, and as a result, they choke the word and he becomes unfruitful. He does not even get to the point of obtaining life. Again, you remember the parable of the four soils and the seed that is sown into them. These are four soils that, in a progressive sense, lead to the soil that bears fruit. These are people who hear the word just like everyone else. But worldly passions and worldly desires do not choke the word, but eventually the word wins out. And it is not the worldly desire that choke out the word. It is the word that chokes out, burns out, roots out the desires in the heart. And this morning we quoted from Hebrews chapter 3, 12 through 17. Once again, this is a text that speaks of the deceitfulness of sin. It is our calling to exhort one another daily while it is called today, so that we may not be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. Now, when you take a text like the one here in Acts chapter 23 and 24, Felix is a prototype of every human being who has come so close to the kingdom and still stays outside. At the same time, you also see the faithfulness of God. Paul has already been preserved in two hearings that had turned violent. This is another case in which, although he is kept in prison, he's kept safe. He's not delivered over to the desire of the Jews. And why is that? God loves Paul. Okay. But that's not specific enough at this point. Why is he not delivered over to the Jews? He must testify in Rome. Remember the words from chapter 22 that we read last week? You must testify to me also in Rome. The reason why we are here, the reason why we continue, the reason why God provides, the reason why God is with us, is because we too have yet something to do in this world. I remember my aunt when she got sicker and sicker, and she became a little bitter. I always asked the question, why am I still here? Why should I still live? The reason was always the same. The answer was always the same. You could only repeat yourselves, because God still has something with you and for you. It's the reason. But all that happens in this life is either to make us join to, or join with, or to make us be with Christ and prepare us for the kingdom of heaven and glory, or it is to turn us away from the truth. There are really only these two options. To stand in the middle, in a neutral ground, is not an option, because there is no such neutral ground. You either are for him or against him. Gather with him, scatter. Those are the only two ways. Any questions or comments about the text that we looked at tonight?